Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I'll give you a few moments to get settled, and while you're doing so, just remind you of the rules that I know you are both well familiar with. You will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It is important that you both state your name and identify the party you represent for our record, as we will be making an audio recording of this session. And be mindful of the lights. You can choose to use either the podium closest to your council table if you prefer. If you decide to use the middle podium, that's where the lighting will be. If you choose to use the side podium, I will try to remember to warn you when you're down to your last 5 minutes. I can't make any promises, but I will do the best I can in that regard. So with that, counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Benjamin Butler. I represent the appellant, Stephen Thornton. This court must reverse Mr. Thornton's guilty plea, allow him to withdraw his plea for any of the reasons cited in our brief. I'd like to try to discuss three of those today, if I might. The false threats of enhanced sentencing, which rendered the plea involuntary, the addition of a conditional release term, which violated the plea agreement, and the fact that Mr. Thornton did not know that he could spend the rest of his life in prison if he violated a condition of release, which rendered the plea unintelligent. To the first question, which is voluntariness, this case is very similar to this court's decision in Johnson from 2019. In Johnson, this court held that the false threat of an enhanced sentence renders a guilty plea involuntary. And here there were multiple false threats, one from the prosecutor and multiple from the defense attorney. The prosecutor falsely threatened to obtain a life sentence on the file ending in 5348 under section 609.3455 subdivision 4A2 if Mr. Thornton did not plead guilty. Mr. Thornton was not eligible for a life sentence in that file. Not that day, not the next day, not no matter how many other charges he may or may not have been charged with.
But on the date that he entered his guilty plea, would he not have been eligible for that life sentence on all of the cases that were resolved through that plea? And doesn't that have an impact on your voluntariness argument?
No, Your Honor. He would not have been eligible for a life sentence on the cases that were resolved. The only cases resolved were the two that he was charged with. On the other two that he was not charged with, that the state agreed not to charge, that is a very different threat. So if the prosecutor's threat is plead guilty or I will do the following, convict you of these two offenses, charge two currently uncharged offenses, proceed to trial on those, obtain convictions on those, and then get all of them sentenced, and at the end of that day, we will seek a life sentence. That is a qualitatively different threat than the one the prosecutor here made. The prosecutor here said, plead guilty, or it's this other thing that you're already charged with that is set for trial, and if you get found guilty of that one, we're going to get a life sentence on it under this subdivision. So it's not a vague general threat to sort of throw the book at the defendant. I'm going to go hard on this one. I'm going to make sure he never sees the light of day. I'm going to seek the maximum sentence.
But Mr. Butler, isn't it true that at the point that he, after the state's case, and he told his attorney, I want to renegotiate a plea agreement, that as of that point, and the court found in the from the post-conviction hearing or the evidentiary hearing, as I understand it, that in fact he knew specifically what the consecutive sentences were. So regardless of the confusion that may have existed prior to that, isn't that conclusive evidence that as of that point he knew he wasn't have it, there was no threat of having it, it was going to be the consecutive 144, the 244 sentences?
No, Your Honor. Sentences. I'm sorry to interrupt the end of your question. No. First of all, there at no point was Mr. Thornton ever made aware that the prosecutor's threat to seek a life sentence was a false one.
About the plea petition that says 30 years is the maximum sentence?
Sure, because 30 years is the statutory maximum sentence for any particular, any of the one offenses he's pleading guilty to. But notwithstanding that, the state can seek a life sentence, a true life sentence, for anything, and that's exactly what they threatened to do. And Mr. Thornton's attorney, because no one knew, like, right, the prosecutor admits that she made a mistake, and that she didn't know that she made a mistake until much late, until we were in these plea withdrawal proceedings. It wasn't until then that she realized that she was wrong and that she could not seek a life sentence. And the defense attorney certainly didn't know that the prosecutor was wrong. In fact, the defense attorney thought the prosecutor was right and told Mr. Thornton several times that one of the things he was doing by pleading guilty was avoiding a life sentence. And that's discussed way back when at the original sentencing hearing, on page 35 of that transcript, when Mr. Thornton is trying to withdraw his plea for the first time, the judge, Judge Karasov, asked the defense attorney, wasn't there some talk about an indictment and a life sentence? And the defense attorney says, yes, there was, and we talked about it, Mr. Thornton and I. And that's one of the things we're avoiding here. So, but he didn't have to plead guilty to avoid a life sentence on file 5348. He was never eligible for a life sentence on that file. Just like Mr. Johnson was never eligible for a life sentence on, for an enhanced sentence on the files at issue in the Johnson case. And that renders the plea involuntary when a plea is preceded by that kind of false threat. It's
but
also
didn't
preceded.
Didn't the district court, I think in the second, the plea withdrawal hearing, address the or consider the argument about what was your client's goal in entering to this plea, and that it was to get 288 months versus some other amount of time, that it wasn't really about, well, conditional release, which I know is a separate argument, or lifetime term, but it's designed to get this amount of months. And it, doesn't that become a fact-finding, a credibility determination from the district court that to which we must defer?
To the extent the district court made fact findings on what people's goals were, sure, I agree with that. But the goal here wasn't 288 as opposed to 360 or 290 or 175 or whatever. 288 was the number that the prosecutor offered mid-trial. The goal was to avoid a life sentence and to get as low a number as possible. I agree with that, which in this case was 288. But that actually gets to the next point, which is, as you said, Your Honor, the deal was 288. The deal was not 288 plus a lifetime conditional release term. And the district court in this case made that fact-finding, that the plea agreement, page 16 of the court's order, the court finds that the plea agreement did not include a conditional release term. And yet the sentence imposed 288 plus life. That violates the plea agreement because the plea agreement is for a number. If you have a plea agreement that's an open, what they call an open plea, right, or for a general guideline sentence, or there's different language, and there's a million cases dealing with this, but the cases are clear that when the deal is for a number, and in this case it was for 288, and the parties use phrases like 288 months in the custody of the Commissioner of Corrections, 288 months with the DOC, Mr. Thornton is not with the DOC for 288 months. He's with the DOC for the rest of his life.
Mr. Butler, I'm having a little bit of a hard time that the concept, in terms of my experience with attorneys negotiating the prison sentence or a term, because my recollection is seldom is there a bifurcated discussion. In fact, oftentimes they leave it to the judge. Oh, by the way, what's the conditional release period that applies, but the negotiation has to do with whether it's the top of the box, the bottom of the box, those sorts of things that happened here. So I'm not sure I understand what appears to be a conflation of a statutory required conditional release, which, by the way, it looks like it's in the plea petition anyway in this case, but that only doesn't mean he's going to be in prison longer than 280 months unless he violates.
Right, but
how does one necessarily follow from the other in terms of the case law regarding if you get 288 and it was 300, well, that would be an error, but it was 288.
Your Honor, if you look at all the older conditional release cases like Jumping Eagle and Wukowitz, this court's decision in Kubrum is actually a really good example of this, where the deal is for a number, 288 or whatever the deal was in those cases, when conditional release is added to it, it doesn't matter that it's quote-unquote mandatory. It is mandatory, but that's exactly the problem. You have to look at it from the defendant's perspective. The defendant has to know, as part of the deal, he thinks he's getting 288 when he pleads guilty. And that's exactly what the district court here found.
Doesn't that go to the intelligence of the plea? I'm struggling. If parties cannot plea agree their way around items like conditional release or registration as a sex offender or whatever terms of probation might end up. I mean, plea agreements don't include everything that's going to be a consequence of a guilty plea. But why would we single this out and say, well, because the parties didn't talk about this at all, it breaches the plea agreement, when this particular defendant was advised before he signed his plea petition that this conditional lifetime conditional release would be part of his sentence, even if it wasn't part of the agreed-to sentence?
I'll try to answer the legal question and then the factual question, Your Honor. The legal question of why conditional release is different is because conditional release is a direct consequence of a conviction. And this court held that in Henthorne way back in 2002. Conditional release is not in anything like sex offender registration, which Your Honor also mentioned. That is a collateral consequence. There's all kinds of collateral consequences that come with a conviction that defendants don't have to be informed about. Conditional release is different. It's a direct consequence, and it's a direct consequence because it's not just supervision. It's supervision with imprisonment to follow and imprisonment for up to the rest of the term. So if it's a lifetime conditional release term, that means imprisonment for life for any violation.
And you say that has to be part of the plea agreement. It can't just be something of which a defendant is advised before he or she pleads guilty.
Correct, Your Honor. Not when the agreement is for a number, when the agreement is for 288 months, because the defendant's not getting the sentence to which he agreed. The sentence to which he agreed is 288 months. Now, whether you call that violation of the plea agreement or you call that part of the intelligence of the plea, I think they're sort of two sides of the same coin. The violation of the plea agreement cases reference both intelligence and voluntariness. So you could go either way with that as your sort of source of authority.
Mr. Butler, what is the impact of the word lifetime in the written plea agreement?
There isn't one. Because the district court, again, made a finding that the plea agreement did not include a conditional release term. That is a factual finding that's reviewed for clear error, and it's not clearly erroneous.
Can you remind me? You said page 16?
Page 16.
And which paragraph?
Sorry. Give me a second.
Is it 27?
Yes, the plea agreement did not include an affirmative agreement as to the applicable period of conditional release. To say things like conditional release can't be negotiated is only partially true. The length of an applicable conditional release term cannot be negotiated, but what parties negotiate all the time and what the prosecutor attempted to negotiate in this very case was the number of convictions the defendant is going to get, which controls the length of a conditional release term. And the trial prosecutor actually tried to point that out to the defense attorney in those emails that are part of the record, where she says something like, if he pleads to one count, that avoids lifetime conditional release. So the defense attorney did not understand that.
What's the impact then of paragraph 29? At the time they reviewed the plea petition, Mr. Gordon and petitioner both knew that lifetime conditional release applied. And I don't know, I can't quite tell if it's the second part of that paragraph that informs the first part. The plea petition notes in Mr. Gordon's handwriting that petitioner guilty plea triggers lifetime conditional release. So I'm trying to understand what we do with that and what more was required in order for it to be an intelligent, if we use intelligent standard.
That was going to be my next point, Your Honor. That gets to the fact finding on page 12, which is that Mr. Gordon did not tell Mr. Thornton that he faced up to life in prison if he violated conditional release.
Mr. Butler, is there a way
what would make the plea intelligent is a statement like that. Please, Judge Bryan.
So I'm trying to understand what that finding at 27 means in light of what comes later about the handwritten term, lifetime. So the finding from the court is it doesn't include an agreement as to the applicable period of release. Is there some way to understand that in terms of it's up to lifetime and what he's looking for? Is there's no agreement as to a specific number of years for conditional release, and that's not necessarily irreconcilable with up to life?
I don't think that would be a fair reading, Judge, and I think you can look at the transcript of the plea hearing for evidence of that. Remember, at the plea hearing, no one says conditional release at all.
Except the district court judge.
Not does. At the plea hearing, Your Honor.
But it's in the plea petition.
It's in the plea petition, but no one says it. So when they say, here's the deal. The deal is he's going to plead to one count in this file, one count in this file. We're going to dismiss the other counts. We're not going to charge the other offenses. He's going to get 144 plus 144, which is 288, with the Commissioner of Corrections. Everybody over and over again says, that's the deal. The deal is not. If someone at that hearing had said, he's going to get 144 plus 144, and of course a lifetime conditional release period comes with that.
If they
then we
said,
would know, then we would know, then we would have a deal.
There is a colloquy where the judge makes clear, you've read every part of this agreement, and you've talked about every part of it with your attorney. So it's not simply, what is the deal? It's 288, full stop. It's, what is the deal? It's 288, and you understand everything else in this petition, which included lifetime conditional release.
Yeah, I see I'm out of time, Judge. May I respond to Judge
Bryan? You may answer the question.
Thank you. Judge, if you look at the record as a whole, it supports the district court's factual finding that conditional release was not part of the plea deal. The plea agreement...
Not part of an agreement.
Well, okay, part of the agreement then. It's not part of what the defendant agreed to when he agreed to waive all his constitutional rights and plead guilty. And so when it's added to that, that violates the agreement. That doesn't mean that just means you have to blow up the agreement and start over again.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Sarah Vokes, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this matter. The court should affirm because appellant's plea was voluntary and intelligent, and he did not establish a valid claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. Critical in this case is the district court's credibility findings. The district court did not find appellant's testimony credible that he did not know about lifetime conditional release. The district court did not find appellant's testimony credible that he would not have pleaded guilty had he known more about lifetime conditional release, which is one of the central questions in a plea withdrawal case. In fact, the district court found appellant's testimony self-serving, unreasonable, and therefore not credible. And without crediting appellant's testimony, appellant's claims, involuntariness, unintelligence, and ineffective assistance of counsel essentially cannot prevail.
Well, I guess I'm struggling a little bit with that conclusion, given that there's sort of two ways to argue the conditional release. One is that it violated the plea agreement, and focus on the, you know, emphasis on the word agreement, and then you look to that finding. The other is intelligence. And I agree with you that as part of the intelligence analysis, we would want to know what was it that the defendant thought. Right, and you look at those credibility determinations potentially, but does that still impact? Does the credibility determination impact the analysis if we're looking at it from the standpoint of this alternative of it's not part of the agreement, and therefore it's a violation of the agreement to impose it?
Right. I would answer that, I think, two ways. I think, first of all, the analysis about whether or not conditional release is a part of the plea agreement primarily stems from this line of cases where a defendant is sentenced, perhaps they're put on probation, and years later, when they're revoked, then the court realizes, oh, we need the conditional release to be imposed.
Right, so, but that's different because that's wasn't part of the sentence.
Right.
So
and
in
that,
terms
and that is,
of the agreement being something different from what was imposed, those cases don't really help us at all. Right.
Right? And in my view, analyzing whether it's part of the plea agreement is primarily something that happens in that universe. But if we think that's relevant here, I think that the credibility findings do still factor in somewhat. In my view, I think that it's, and I think the panel is getting at sort of this combination of findings in the district court's order. I think that that appellant is ascribing more importance to the finding under paragraph 27 than I think is appropriate. It does say the plea agreement did not include an affirmative agreement as to the applicable period of conditional release. It goes on to say, the court goes on to say that these are things that can't be negotiated. And so I think when read in the context of the evidentiary hearing, the district court is acknowledging, as was brought up before, this is not something that is typically negotiated because it's mandatory. And I think that coupled with the finding under number 29 that at the time they reviewed the plea petition, Mr. Gordon and petitioner both knew that lifetime conditional release applied. I think that there's multiple places we can see that, yes, it wasn't something that was part of the negotiation, but it was certainly part of the agreed-upon sentence. You know, and maybe that's splitting hairs.
So your argument is that you don't need to agree to a conditional release term if it's mandatory.
I think the defendant needs to be on notice,
if
right? Like cases
it.
Like, oh,
just
I'm sorry.
Sorry, no, it's fine. I don't mean to, like, throw you off, but I just want to complete the thought here. So you're arguing that you don't need to agree that you don't need to agree if the conditional release term is required. That doesn't have to be part of the agreement that you're reaching.
I think that certainly cases like State versus Rhodes tell us that a defendant needs to be on notice. You know, they need to know it's there. And I realize it's kind of entangling perhaps plea, like the plea agreement sort of line of thinking and intelligence, but in my mind, a case like this really should be analyzed under the intelligent requirement. That makes more sense to me in the legal framework.
Folks, I was just going to ask you that. Would you then, is your theory explanation it's more on par to a Padilla direct consequence of which it has to be acknowledged and understood will result as a part of the separate agreement?
I think that maybe that's a fair comparison because the parties can't negotiate it, I can see that, you know, maybe a cleaner plea hearing, the prosecutor is going to say, this is the negotiation these months, and of course we all know this applies, right? And we don't have that in the plea hearing. We don't have sort of maybe that clean transcript that we'd prefer, and then we wouldn't be here. But we do know that the defendant was on notice. It's in the plea petition that the word lifetime is there. In addition, we have it bolstered by the testimony at the evidentiary hearing where Mr. Gordon did say that he talked about conditional release with his client. So his client knew all along that that was a piece of this sentence no matter what. So even though the parties weren't actively negotiating, the defendant was on notice. He knew about it. It's in the plea petition. So we have, you know, I think that's enough. I think that
is there any record evidence of what the appellant understood conditional release and particularly the lifetime of conditional release to mean?
I would say that I don't think that there's a strong indication in the record merely because his testimony at the evidentiary hearing, I believe, is that he didn't know that conditional release, he was never told about conditional release, and that, you know, he didn't know what it was, he didn't know what it meant, he didn't know that he even was going to have conditional release, his attorney didn't tell him anything about it. And the district court obviously doesn't give any weight or credibility to those findings. So then what we're left with is the district court did find Mr. Gordon credible, and Mr. Gordon did tell him about conditional release, that he did tell him they wrote lifetime in the petition. The petition also has the language that it may extend your time in prison. So it's clear that Mr. Gordon never said you are spending the rest of your life in prison because of this conditional release term, but I think we'd have a different problem if he did. You know, I don't think that would be accurate information either. But so I think that the best, you know, information we have about, you know, what he knew is we have information about what he was told, if that answers your question. Does the panel have any other questions?
Do you have a response to Mr. Butler? His first line of discussion was that the first issue related to the false representation of a life sentence. And part of his point, which I understand, is that you've got these two cases floating out here without any charges. And while it was part of a discussion, it does seem a bit speculative to not only then presume those now charged, then presume all the dots would have to connect in order to get to a point of a lifetime sentence. So what impact, how should we view this record in light of that undeniably false information, at least at the time that it was given, on the basis it was given?
Right. I would say, I have a couple points to make on that. I would say the first is that appellant is arguing that it is important that it wasn't a vague threat, but that it was a specific threat as to this case file, and that this case file could incur a life sentence now. And in the state's view, I think that the fact that at the evidentiary hearing, appellant himself testified he didn't remember which case file that was on or what the mechanism was that they were going to get there, I think that kind of undercuts that argument that the specificity of the threat matters. Obviously, it is regrettable that the prosecutor gave false information. You know, she made a mistake, it happens, and it's not clear on the record when it was she realized that particular subdivision doesn't apply.
But is it clear that she realized that after making the threat?
As opposed to, I'm not sure I understand the question. I don't know if
whenever she did understand that wasn't available under that section, that was, let's say, after not only making the statement, but potentially even after the plea had gone through.
My assumption, I don't think it's clear on the record, is that it's after the plea, after sentencing, perhaps in the course of these proceedings. I'm not sure when that occurred, to be honest. And I think that it's not clear in the record. I don't think that anybody, rather other than probably the parties who were there, know when that occurred. But yeah, it's clear that was a mistake, it's an error, and that it was not corrected, I assume, until after sentencing. So I think my first point to answer your question is that, to me, the specificity of the threat doesn't necessarily carry the weight that appellant is giving it, because appellant himself, he didn't have sort of that understanding that it's like, oh, it's specifically on this case file. And then I think that we can also look to the testimony at the evidentiary hearing, wherein Mr. Gordon testified he thought an upward departure was likely, that I believe Mr. Gordon said he thought those other two cases that weren't charged were chargeable. So there's some weight to that this was a universe of possibilities. I also think
by unifying all of the two charges to which he pled guilty and the state agreeing not to go forward with the other potentially chargeable cases, that lumping all that together makes the plea voluntary, because in fact, if you lumped all that together, assuming guilty verdicts or pleas to all of them, that in fact a life sentence was
right. I think that it is possible, and I think my brief kind of outlines the way I see that being possible in terms of a conviction with an aggravating factor, a conviction, and then pursuing an indictment on one of the uncharged cases.
What case law would support that approach?
Well, I think that that what we're doing is looking at the context of the voluntariness, you know, and there are cases that sort of have you look at sort of the bigger picture. And here, it is clear that a specific threat was made it was baseless, right? It was incorrect. However, I think that it's different from Johnson, where there's one charge, they're threatening to use an enhancement, and that's not true, end of story. Here we have multiple charges. We have the possibility of consecutive sentencing versus concurrent sentencing. We have Blakely filed on both of the cases that are filed. So I understand that as far as this particular, this prong of the voluntariness argument, it is about the life sentence threat. And the reason I think that is essentially that it's not coercion, it's not involuntary, because it was possible in another avenue. But I think that additionally, I would say that I know that appellant is arguing that he was trying to avoid a life sentence, that his attorney was, you know, testified repeatedly that the goal was to avoid a life sentence. But I think that when you read the evidentiary hearing carefully, yes, they were concerned about the threat of the life sentence, but sort of secondarily, Mr. Gordon was concerned that his client was facing a very large sentence. So it wasn't necessarily just the threat of a life sentence, but he thought he was going to get convicted on this case with multiple victims. In his professional experience, this particular district court judge seemed likely to, you know, depart. And so in a case like this, even just if he had proceeded to trial, if we'd gotten, you know, guilty verdicts, he could be facing 500 some months without an upward departure, just stacking and consecutive sentencing. And so I think that the entire context of understanding that Mr. Gordon was highly concerned about his client ending up with the functional equivalent of life sentence as well, like there's multiple layers to the concern, that informs this as well. If there are no further questions, I'm happy to entertain any other questions on the issues. I would just conclude by stating that Respondent State of Minnesota respectfully requests this court affirm the district court's denial, and that I ask this court to give due deference to the district court's factual and credibility findings below.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Butler, you have the last word.
Thank you. I wanted to address a couple of Judge Bjorkman's questions. Judge Bjorkman asked counsel if anyone told Mr. Thornton what conditional release meant, especially lifetime conditional release. Judge Bjorkman, the answer to that is no. On page 12 of the district court's order, paragraph 8, the district court makes a factual finding that Mr. Gordon did not tell Mr. Thornton that he could spend the rest of his life in prison if he violated a term of conditional release, a lifetime conditional release term. That is the kind of information. Does a lawyer have to go through every possible condition of parole? No, of course not. But you have to tell a defendant who is facing life in the custody of the Commissioner of Corrections, physical or legal, that he could spend life in the custody of the Commissioner of Corrections, physical or legal, if he pleads guilty and takes this deal. And the case law and the briefs talk about the Department of Corrections revokes people all the time for all kinds of things, including things totally beyond their control, like the lack of available housing. And once a person's conditional release is revoked, the Department of Corrections never, ever has to let that person out again until the end of the term, which for a person with lifetime conditional release means life, means never. Now, the state's only response to that is that can't possibly be what it means. The state's brief argues that the statutes don't, in fact, give the DOC the authority to imprison someone for life on a lifetime conditional release term. And I would love for that to be true, and so would my clients, but it is not true. The statutes very clearly give the department that kind of authority, and the department exercises it on a daily basis. They're doing it right now.
So the written agreement, or the plea agreement, and I don't mean to emphasize agreement in this case, because as we've already said, you don't believe that the conditional release term is part of the agreement. So the document that we're calling the agreement includes a
paragraph. You mean the petition, Your Honor? We're talking about the petition.
Yes.
Right? Okay. Yes.
Okay. So the petition includes, in that paragraph, violating the terms of this conditional release may increase the time I serve in prison. In this case, the period of conditional release is lifetime. It's your argument that that's not clear to Mr. Thornton that he could spend life in prison?
No, it's not clear.
If he violates?
Correct.
Okay, so what needs to change to that language? Violating the terms of this may increase the time of the conditional release may increase the time I serve. In this case, the period of conditional release is lifetime. What additional statement has to be there?
Take the language from 609.3455, the conditional release statute, which says the department can revoke the conditional release for up to the remainder of the term. So if the plea petition said, I could serve the remainder of the conditional release term in prison, in this case, that means, quote, life in prison for a violation. Something like that would probably be sufficient. It also would sure help if in addition to the boilerplate language in a plea petition, which I know the defense attorney said he went over with the client, and I think all of you were district court judges, and you know what that means in most cases, it would sure help if someone actually told the defendant that, which Rule 15 says the judge is supposed to do. The judge, not the defense lawyer. Rule 15 says the judge at the plea hearing is supposed to explain the conditional release term to the defendant and ensure that the defendant understands, because that's such an important part of pleading guilty. The judge here did not do that.
So you're suggesting that the district court judge asking, as Judge Karasoff did here, did your lawyer go through each and every line with you and answer any question, that's not enough?
That's not enough. Rule 15 says that's not enough. If that's all the judge had to do, Rule 15 would say that, would say judge must ensure that defendant and lawyer went over the plea petition. But Rule 15 has some very detailed requirements for what the district court judge must do, and there's a reason for that. It's not just dotting the I's and crossing the T's, it's making sure that the defendant understands what he's getting into. Judge Bjorkman also asked counsel if there was any case law that supported counsel's view of the voluntariness issue here, combining a bunch of cases together with a bunch of hypotheticals. The answer to that question is also no. Simple answer is no. And finally, Judge Bryan asked about this, over the language about whether a person has to agree as part of a plea agreement to a term of mandatory conditional release. And
right. is it enough to think analogous to the Padilla, where acknowledging it, notice is sufficient, you actually have to make it part of the quote-unquote agreement?
Judge Bryan, the answer to that is no. You actually have to make it part of the agreement. And Wukowicz and Jumping Eagle and Brown and every case cited in Wukowicz say exactly that. That when the deal is for what I call a number, the phrasing the Supreme Court used, I'm sorry, Judge, I see I'm out of time. Can I just finish
the
thought?
Thank
you, Judge Bjorkman. When the deal is for a number and the addition of conditional release exceeds what the Supreme Court calls the bargained for sentence, then it violates the plea agreement. The bargained for sentence in this case is 288 months. You know that by reading the plea transcript and by listening to the defense attorney's testimony and by reading the district court's order in this case, which made that as a factual finding, that that was the deal, not 288 months plus life.
Judge Bjorkman, may I follow up briefly? So what you just said was that those cases showed that it violates the agreement if it's in excess of the bargain for sentence. My specific question is, does that also make it unintelligent, or are those cases more about intelligence of the plea, and you meant to say intelligence but said violates the plea agreement?
I will defer to the Supreme Court on how the Supreme Court defined which constitutional provision. I don't have Wukowicz in front of me. So to me, Wukowicz is the best case because it lays out all the prior ones, including Jumping Eagle. I think it's more of a due process issue that when you have a bargained for number under Santabello versus New York, when you have a deal for X, if it's X plus 10, that violates the deal. And whether that's a due process issue or an intelligence issue or a voluntariness issue, maybe it's all of them. But what it does is it results in plea withdrawal. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your helpful arguments and briefing. We really appreciate that. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. That is the last case scheduled for oral argument before this panel today, so we are in recess.